all kinds of shuffling things around, apparently. Yeah. So I have a message this morning that has a very strange title. You know, I always do these titles well ahead, and I looked at that like on last Monday or Tuesday, and I went, what am I talking about this week? It said, the convergent method. And it didn't sound nearly as interesting as when I chose that topic and was kind of excited about it. But I really found that there's something quite lovely about this message of the way things in life converge together for some type of experience of oneness or of connection. And so what excited me about it was that because CSL, all the CSL centers are looking at celebrating 100 years of the Science of Mind teaching, I thought that this was a perfect way of us looking at our teaching, at the founder of our teaching, Dr. Ernest Holmes. And so I'm going to give you a little history today. So for those of you who are new to the teaching, or those of you who haven't taken a lot of classes or heard me do this before, I've got some stuff to say. And for the rest of you, I hope I've thought of a few things you haven't heard from me already, because there certainly is a lot to talk about. But the bottom line is that when I'm looking at this idea of a convergent method, what I was thinking is that that's the gift that Ernest Holmes brought. And he studied so many different spiritual traditions, but he dedicated his life to looking for those threads of truth that are universal, and that's what this faith is based upon. And I do love, it's so interesting that you said that today, because I intended to say we are a philosophy, we are a faith, and we are a way of life. So we're not all that religious, and yet we are deeply spiritual. So we used to have a license plate ring that we sold in our bookstores, and I think it said, I don't know if it said religious science or science of mind at the top, a philosophy of faith and a way of life. And I love that because it feels so relevant to me, in as much as more and more people are looking for a spiritual path, but they're not so interested in being in a rigid religion where there is exclusion to other faiths and other ways of practicing spirituality. So the basics of the teaching of the Science of Mind really fall under that idea that there are certain spiritual laws in the universe, and the one that I'll be referencing a lot today is the law of harmony. I'll be speaking about the law of correspondence, the law of reflection, and I'm sort of bundling these together. They're not all different things you have to learn. You know, there will be no test later. I just want you to see that there are lots of ways that we language all of these things that we study. And finally, we will be talking about mental equivalence. So if that sort of packages up everything we teach in all the classes we offer. And I want to give you some very basic ideas as to what that all means. And I think if we look at this idea of love, because it is this week of celebrating kind of that romantic love, which I love, but I really don't like somebody to tell me I should do that on a certain day. I'm kind of a rebel that way. But that idea of Valentine's Day and that theme of love that comes with that is, now this is my very own definition. I just made this up, but I think it's kind of cool. So that I would say that love is the convergence of two souls that are destined to learn things from each other. Because that's for me what love is. I've had this great romance. I've been with this guy for 47 years. We have 4 kids and 10 grandkids and a great grandkid. And boy, have we done love well. And I just noticed that it's also been spicy by some things that are not quite qualified as love. And that when you bundle it all together, then it makes something of substance. So I liked my definition. Love is the convergence of two souls destined to learn things from each other. I think sometimes that's why separation happens, is because maybe as a couple, you have learned all there is to learn with each other. And so when you're complete in that work, then you're free to move on. And so we try not to have a lot of opinion about endings, because we know that there's always something else. There's another opportunity for us to grow. So convergence is what happens, spiritually speaking. I'm going to say convergence is what happens when people or ideas come together for the greater good of the whole, of the all of us. So it reminds me very much of our global heart statement, the global vision that says we believe in a world that works for everyone. See, when we come together just in a consciousness around that idea, we create incredible possibilities for good things to unfold on the earth. So I wanted to read to you a quotation out of the book. There'll be two books I'll be using all year. I'll be playing in all year. And my goal is to read you a different quote from these books that were written in 1918 by the founder of this teaching, Dr. Ernest Holmes. And the quotation I wanted to read this morning fits in with that idea of sort of spiritual convergence. And here's what Dr. Holmes says, 1918. He was, what did I say, 30, what would that make him, 31 years old. It was just before he stumbled on the teachings of Thomas Troward. So if you read this book, Creative Mind, if you like Holmes and you're interested in all this stuff, because I really like all this, and then the book he wrote right after this and published in the same year is Creative Mind and Success, you will hear his voice before he stumbled onto the writings of Troward. And Troward, I'll talk about him in a minute, but he sort of flavored our teaching in a very strong way because Holmes fell so much in love with him. But listen to what Ernest Holmes said in this short passage in the front of this book. God governs the universe through great mental laws that are always operating from intelligence. So see, we use that term law as much in the same way there are natural laws like gravity or chemistry. There are certain laws that always work exactly. There are also spiritual laws. And so all of the great metaphysicians of the past, the ancient wisdom and new thought, ancient wisdom that we package it all together. So here he's saying that God governs the universe through these laws, but he calls them mental laws. So mind is the working of the mind. We always say that there's one mind. It is the mind of God, and my mind is one with that mind now. And when we align ourselves consciously in that way, that's a really good beginning to a powerful prayer. And then he goes on to say that those laws are always operating from intelligence. This intelligence is so vast and the power is so great that our human minds cannot even grasp it. Now, I think this is really important for us to think about because we study this stuff and we gain an understanding of it. A lot of what we do is very intellectual. But Holmes tells us pretty frequently that we can't really even grasp it. And that's because we have a finite mind. We live in finite physical bodies in this infinite universe. And so there are just some things that are a little harder to comprehend for us in the basis of us just being a part of humanity. All that we can hope to do then is to learn something about the way it works by harmonizing ourselves with it, with that law, with that intelligence that created the whole universe. We align ourselves with spirit so that our lives are now controlled by this great harmony. So, you know, it's that same old idea that what we're thinking about creates sort of an energetic vibration as we move through our day. And if you're having a tough day, you're going to see through that lens and you will not be able to notice the good things that are going on in life And so we teach skills that help you to get back to being able to see what's working and what's good. Gratitude is a great place to start, by the way. And that's how we can then change our view or our perspective. So I wanted to give you a little history of Dr. Holmes so that you can begin to understand how so much of what we teach has a very earthy tone to it. At least from my perspective, it's beautifully down to earth and very real. Ernest Holmes was one of how many kids were kids were in the Holmes family? Anybody know?
Nine.
There were nine children, and they were all boys. I just think that'd be real hard. Have you held? Maybe not as hard as nine girls. Maybe that would be harder. But I always like to say at this point that my grandma Skelly had nine kids and she had eight sons and then gave birth to a girl. So it was very close to, and boy, was she spoiled. So he was the youngest of nine boys, and he grew up in rural Maine. His mother and father, Anna and William Holmes, owned a small farm, and it wasn't a great farm. It was on this hilly, rocky property, and his dad was a great inventor. He liked to invent ways to collect the eggs from the chickens and stuff, but he wasn't very good at working the land. And so by the time Ernest, the youngest of the children, was about 12 years old, they actually lost that farm. It was repossessed by the bank, and they had to move into town. But what that meant was that most of his childhood was spent on that property, and surrounding the farm was this great vast forest that they played in all their lives. And so there's this way in which we can see that Ernest, who was very intuitive and curious and loved to study, learned to read at a young age, and he grew up in this home that was they were well loved, there's no question. The family attended church every Sunday and read the Bible every evening before they put the boys to bed. What was interesting, however, was that the parents, Anna and William, were also not really traditional Christians in that they didn't teach the boys any fear-based spirituality. So there was no hell. They were never taught there was an opposing force to God called Satan, the devil, or anything else. And Ernest said in one of his later writings that he was actually a grown man before he realized people believed there was a real thing called the devil. It was such a foreign mythological concept to him. What that meant was that mom often had little verbal wrestling matches with the new ministers when they came into town because she was quite insistent her boys would not be taught any fear-based religion. So you can see that from a young age, there was this great exposure to nature, this great love of spiritual matters, a real strong emphasis on education. And yet, Ernest himself, of all the brothers, was the one who was the most resistant to formal schooling. So the only thing he ever finished and got a certificate for finishing was something he did in his 20s or 19 or 20. He attended he went to Boston and he attended the Leland Powers School of Elocution. And he completed that class and got a certificate for it. And all his other honors were gifts that were given to him. However, he was extremely academic and scholastically prone, you might say. So mom would take them to the library, so much so that they read every book. The boys were all avid readers. They read every book in the library, and then they would have to hitch the wagon and go to the next town over to find books for the boys to read that they had not read before. So you just see this good model of something open-minded. There is some suggestion that the mother, Anna, may have been a transcendentalist when William met her before they were married, and then that opened them to be thinking a little more open-minded when they were younger. They also used to study, mom and dad would put the boys to bed and they would study Henry Drummond, which was about science and spirituality, and it was very controversial. It was kind of secretive. It was a correspondence course that, so you can see that he also was exposed to that, some the scientific ideas that really predated what we now look at and call quantum physics. So when Holmes was about somewhere between 17 and 19, there's some disagreement about his age, he discovered Emerson's essays. So Ralph Waldo Emerson came into his life, and because he was already well-read and enthusiastic about all kinds of philosophies and traditions, he fell in love with these ideas that were in Emerson's essays. Now, keep in mind, I think I wrote the year down, it was like 1905 when he first read Emerson's essays. And Emerson was kind of, it was scandalous. You didn't tell people if you were reading Emerson because he was really out of the box and considered a little bit naughty in his brave ways of looking at God and spirituality slightly different. Ernest found that he loved Emerson so much that he couldn't put him down. He was sort of obsessed with reading the essays over and over. And at one point he said that reading Emerson to him was like drinking water. You know, it satisfied that thirst he had for more and more. Then time continued on, and Ernest's brother Fenwick, who was the closest to him in age and also the brother he was the closest to, Fenwick took mother and their mom and moved them to the Los Angeles area. They actually lived in Chino for a while. Probably, I don't know if it was Chino Hills or Chino then, but Chino, California. But they didn't like the summer weather there, so then they moved all the way to the ocean, and they lived in Venice Beach, and Ernest Holmes moved out and joined them. And he got himself a job, and while he was working in the Southern California area, he discovered a metaphysical library in Santa Monica. And that was where he discovered Thomas Troward. And then he just ate that up. And what he said about reading Troward was that it took everything he loved about Emerson, but it put it in an understandable way. So it now looks like a method that can be actually practically applied. And so, he loved Troward, and everywhere he went, he was talking about it. So some of his coworkers said to him, you know, I think there are other people that would enjoy hearing that. Why don't you come over to our house? We'll invite some people over, and you can just tell us some of those things you talk about all day long. And so he did, and the living room was full of people, and they asked him to come once a week, and then the place got packed until they couldn't meet there anymore, and they had to start renting places to have these conversations. So I want you to notice, he never set out to be somebody. He didn't. He didn't have any aspiration to be a great leader. He did not wake up one morning and decide he would write these great books or start a movement. He never had any of that. The people came to him. And I think a lot of great things happen that way if we pay attention. The other piece that I think is important is that, you know, it makes me laugh. Sometimes people say, oh, but that's a cult. You belong to a cult. And it's like, please just go look up the dictionary definition of cult and you will see we not only don't tell you what to believe, we barely have any leaders, you know, and if we try and lead you, we always say it's like herding cats, you know, because we teach you to think for yourself. You know, we don't tell you what to believe. We don't have any precepts that, what was that? Yeah. Oh, yeah, right. I know, because we're all a bunch of rebels. You know, what are you going to do? And so So it always makes me laugh when we get referred to as a cult. I think people just don't know what it means, and what they're saying is, oh, you think different than we do, and I'm scared. You know, I want you to die and go to heaven and be in heaven with me. And because we're sort of independent and really encourage people to find your own personal theology, that's what I believe we do best here. I'm going to be emphasizing that all year long. There are ways in, and we don't have a leader. You know, we have a leader because we have to have a corporate leader, you know, but we don't have anybody we follow, and we did not follow Ernest Holmes. So I think it's confusing because I'm such a fan of his. It would be easy for you to hear me talk every Sunday and think that it's more like he's a leader, but I just love people that I deeply respect. You know, Holmes and Hugh, I get them confused all the time. It's like so close. The names are so close. So he was very fussy at the end of his life, and he got involved in writing his own biography because he did not want people to think he was a saint or that God had given him some special revelation. He wanted to be accepted for being a real human with foibles, you know. He was short, he was overweight, he smoked, and he wore glasses, you know, and he was a really genuinely kind and good man. He loved people, and everybody seemed to love him. So I want to read you this quote that comes from a wonderful book. It's been out of print for a long time, and I looked on Amazon when I was writing the talk this week. There aren't many left to get that aren't like $75 or more now. And someday this book really needs to be reprinted because I think it's the best. It's just such an enjoyable read, and it's the best information. He participated in the writing of this book by making recordings, and it wasn't actually written and published until after he passed, and his brother Fenwick made sure it was published. So Fenwick said in Ernest Holmes' His Life and Times, "My brother had not heard then, nor did he later recognize any call that he would admit to. He heard no voices, he got no visions, he had no sudden illumination. He always insisted that the understanding he developed was the result of natural growth using a law and faculties and a power that is indwelling in every human being." So everything that he came to understand is the same information that we could find on our own, but what he did and what he is well known for and what he bragged about when he was still living was he believed he synthesized great religious truths from all spiritual traditions, and he put it into a method, and that's the Science of Mind well-read textbook of that Cheryl was reading from this morning. We call that our textbook. It is not our Bible. And Ernest Holmes quoted the Bible quite frequently. I was an old fundamental Christian, and I got to tell you, he made me crazy when I first started reading the Science of Mind textbook because he never tells you where it is in the Bible. You can't, and he paraphrased, so it was really painful to try and look things up, and I like to look things up. But I got used to it, and I guess now I do it. Now I imitate him. I'm not sure that's good or bad. But I have a story about him that is very fitting with this idea of convergence in the way that we, when we align ourselves to the presence of God in our own life, that there's something that happens where we may or may not be able to articulate what that is, but we would describe it as either a communion, a connection, or an experience of oneness with God. In the Course in Miracles, they call it a holy moment. I like that because it's just a moment. And the story is from when Holmes was probably 6 to 8 years old. And the boys used to play in the woods, but the church organist, Miss Hall, used to come on their property and sit in the woods and sketch. She was a very accomplished artist. And so she would go sit in the woods, sketch out her stuff, and take it back, and then do her painting. But she had an observable love of nature. And so when she would arrive, if they happened to watch her, she would hug the trees and she would talk to the trees. And all the boys would make fun of her. All the brothers would make fun of her. But Ernest, even as a little boy, understood there was something else going on. Fenwick worded it this way. He said, Ernest knew that Miss Hall was talking to a living something. And she knew that those trees understood whatever it was she was speaking to them about. Or communicating, and that there was an exchange of communication going on. Even as a child, he intuited that to be true. And this habit that he had as a young boy of communing with nature, or realizing some kind of a connection to God in nature, while he was in nature, is what probably served him in the most intimate way as he matured into a man and began then writing and sharing this methodology. But I want you to hear that there were always for Holmes, he spoke about there's love and there's law, and so there's spiritual practice, but he urged us to know that part of our spiritual practice is that idea of sitting still, of opening yourself to recognizing that presence right where you are. So whether or not you meditate, or call it meditation, or take long walks in nature, I think that all of us, every man, woman, and child, we really crave that connection, and we might not be able to articulate it. We might not be able to speak what it is. We might feel loneliness in other ways and try and fill that gap in other ways in our lives. But the reality is something in us is clearly aware that there's more going on, and that there is that place where communing is a form of converging or becoming one with or having an experience of connection with something that is greater than we are. We must not minimize that idea of experience. So for the rest of his life, when he was living in Maine, he would return to the farm even when they didn't own the farm anymore, and he would go sit in the woods. And that was how he began his spiritual practice. He would go to the woods. He would commune with the trees. Then he would go back to he'd run a buggy. He'd take the horse and buggy back to where he boarded. He had a room that he, in a boarding house. And then he would read the Bible or some other sacred text, because remember, he studied all the sacred texts of the world. And then he would fluff up the pillows on his bed, and he would sit in bed and contemplate all that had happened during that day. That was his spiritual practice. We can learn from these things. You see, this is a man who loved the intellectual path. He loved reading, he loved studying, he loved contemplating, and he loved the experience of oneness, and he looked for that. Now, I want to take you to something current day, something modern. I have a favorite author and an amazing woman in leadership named Meg Wheatley. How many of you have heard of Margaret Wheatley, Meg Wheatley? Wow, she is really, I would love to go to a conference that she did. She's not only an author, we had to read her when I was in seminary, we had to read more than a couple of her books. And she serves as a business consultant. She studies organizational behavior and systems thinking and theories in change. And I think we're going to be looking more and more at some of the work that Meg Wheatley has brought to our world. But I want to read a quote from you. And the interesting thing about this quote, I'm not sure how Spirit directs me to stuff, but I was sitting at my desk and I saw a binder from my installation. So an installation is a big formal ceremony that you, when you get a new minister, you plan this. You have to wait a few months. You don't do it right away in case things don't work out, you know, because it's kind of like the marriage. It's like a formal, it's like the marriage, the official, you take vows and everything. And so we did my installation about, I don't know, it was 7 or 8 months, I think, after I had been here already. So I found the binder, and I had this Margaret Wheatley quote read during my installation, and it just thrills me to see now how much more relevant these words are now than they were 7 years ago. Life is attracted to order. Everywhere we look, we see life combining with other life. The universe pulses with forces that call individuals together to form unified wholes. The history of life on our planet is a history of organization, of disorganization, and reorganization. Life opens to more possibilities through new patterns of connection. Ring a bell? Sound timely for the days we're living in? Organization, disorganization, and reorganization. It is normal. Nature does it all the time. And so change always looks chaotic, but when I reread these brilliant words, it just gives me tremendous hope. It's the very thing that helps me deal with the things that frighten me in the changes that we see in life in all kinds of ways. You know, because there's change going on in our environment, in nature. All of us experience change in our relationships. Those things are alive. You know, that is an entity. It's on of its own. So it's living and breathing and growing and shifting and changing. Our spiritual community is another group of souls that come together, but we are a living, breathing entity, always growing and shifting and moving and changing, as well as the community at large, everything out there, as well as all the governments, as well as the way we come together as humanity on planet Earth, all of it. Everywhere we look, we will see that life is attracted to order. And when things get out of order, things have to change and be rearranged, and it looks disorganized and chaotic or worse, but then reorganization can occur. I love, there's a great Swedenborg quote, Emanuel Swedenborg, and he said something like, when things break apart, then it's because they didn't fit together well. And then God can rearrange them in a better order. And I like that because I think that's what's always going on. But the question is, you know, how do you get over some things? And I would say that nature shows us that it's by being adaptable. So, you know, how adaptable are you? You know, I mean, I really sometimes think, wow, I'm pretty flexible. You know, I'm adaptable. I can do things. Except, can I just tell you how badly I wished I didn't have to use a remote to change the doggone TV? I would just love it if I could just go over there and turn a knob, and that was also the volume control, right? And that there was another knob over here, a big round one, that would change the channels. You know, I wouldn't even mind having the little antenna you have to move to get channel CBS or whatever's in the low number there, right? So, yes, we are adaptable, and yet I would ask you to think this morning, I'd like you to first, don't answer out loud, but what are some of the big changes you've made in your life? Right? Some of them you wanted, some of them plopped into your life because somebody else had another idea. What are some changes you've had to face where you know you had a lot of resistance to it? And again, don't say it out loud. Where have you had resistance in your change? And then finally, What's in your life right now that is trying to get your attention because it needs a change? You know, where are we not seeing that maybe it's time to do something new? I still have Windows XP on my favorite computer. And every day it gives me that scary message. This computer is no longer protected by, you know. It's like, I know, but it has the best games. They don't make the game. And those statistics on the games, I can't let that go, you know. So how many of you, and again, don't raise your hand, but how many of you just are not even willing to look at Windows 10 yet, you know? So, you know, or you don't have you're just getting comfortable with the idea of a smartphone. Whatever it is. Change is inevitable, and I can resist the remote control forever if I so choose to. Nobody cares, and guess who it's inconvenient for? Only me, right? Because there are things I don't know how to do on it. I'm always saying to my husband, how do you make it go back to that channel it was just on, you know? How do you look up the stars, you know? No, you do it. You just do it. It'll be easier. And consequently, we forget because it feels like, oh, but it was so nice to just change the channel or turn it up. We forget how much we love Netflix or the other whatever TV contract you hold. You know, we like that. I like that stuff. You don't have to like it with me, but I do. And so, you know, when we start looking at it that way, we can begin to understand that asking yourself, how adaptable are you, is a really good question. Because when we look at mental equivalence, here's the truth. Life meets you right where you're at. Life will meet you right where you're at, no matter what. It's always reflecting back to you. And that's why we talk so much here about cause and effect and about the way all the spiritual study that we can do, and I don't just mean here, I mean generally speaking, you know, pick up the top 40 list on the nonfiction anytime you want and see that there are always a big stack of spiritual titles in there. We're all reading the same stuff, don't matter where you go to church. But I noticed that that I totally put myself in a corner. Where do you think I was going? Where are you, Mark Reed? Bail me out now, Mark Reed. That my life meets us exactly where we are. So what I was going to say is that's why everything we teach here is about stretching our consciousness, because then we are changing the shape of the container. We're like a vessel. We're like Holmes being thirsty for Emerson. So what are you thirsty for? We got to stretch our container to a new shape so we can take in new information. It's not a lot different than cleaning out your closet so you can put some new clothes in it. So I wanted to end this morning with this gorgeous quote from Holmes out of that book, His Life and Times. And he says these words. Think of electricity. It has no goals. It just is. However, it can be individualized into light. It can be used for heat. We use it for power. This is an undifferentiated universal intelligence. In human terms, it is a quality of being, or it is our consciousness. And it responds to each of us in terms of our approach to it. Therefore, here's where it gets good. It reflects wisdom to the thinker, and peace to the peaceful, and love to the lover. And you know what that says. We could list the opposites, right? And see that life is always reflecting to us as we are looking out through the lens of our own view, our own beliefs, our own ideas. So choose, my friends, choose. Select what it is, the desires that you ache to or you thirst for. choose, select, and then initiate, because there are universal spiritual principles that are laws that will support you in having those desires fulfilled in a great, great way. Steer your mind to converge with the great harmony of all of life. And so I want to anchor these ideas in some words of prayer. We'll do some steering right now. And I would like to call forward all of the practitioners. And practitioners, I want you to surround this room, and I want you to really be that part of the high watch that allows us all to have a clearer imagining of what's possible. So take a nice deep breath, my friends.